Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends to doctors in women's health.
My name is Dr. Rachel Phelps, and I'm with the Rochester LARC Initiative. Today, we'll be talking about LARC in the time of COVID and telehealth, and I'm happy to be joined by Dr. Amber Trueheart of the University of Chicago's Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, their section of family planning and contraceptive research. So welcome, Dr. Trueheart, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Phelps. I'm super excited to be here.
Me too. So Dr. Trueheart, we read the article in Social Impact related to short-acting methods of contraception that can be prescribed pretty easily with contraceptive counseling via telehealth. So starting with that sort of framework, we'd like to get your expertise on using telemedicine as an effective way to provide other contraceptive counseling and methods related to LARC or long-acting reversible contraception. So what can you share with us about how patients have been able to access LARC methods during the pandemic?
I think pretty soon after the pandemic in about April of 2020, we were lucky that we kind of got our telehealth services up pretty quickly. And so patients at that point were being, unless they had something that was like urgent that needed to be seen with like a physical exam, they were kind of being shuttled more towards the telehealth option. And we were able to do all of contraceptive counseling. So I think it's not like we were focusing mostly on short acting. We were kind of doing comprehensive counseling. And then depending on what they picked and what they were currently using, trying to figure out how we could get them into clinic as soon as possible if they were interested in something like a LARC device. I would say a lot of patients at that point were also a little bit concerned maybe about coming into the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so they were picking more like bridge methods or maybe short-term methods with the plans of in a couple of months, you know, getting my one-time like sub-Q depot shot and then coming in a couple of months to get an IUD.
Great. So your clinical practice is in an academic hospital setting, correct?
Yes.
And so just for contrast, that's in the Chicago area. My clinical practice is in Planned Parenthood in upstate New York. One of the things that we saw, people got really creative about how to get people access to contraception during the pandemic and to really limit people's risk. So one of the things, actually not our Planned Parenthood, but our local academic OBGYN clinic was doing was actually having people do drive-up depot shots. And so the patient would actually drive into the parking lot of the hospital, call up to the clinic, and a nurse would run down and give them their shot in the car. Like they could just pop their arm out, get their shot, go on their way, which I just thought was like incredibly, you know, clever. And, you know, what I love about, I think people's sort of creativity around how to keep people's access to contraception during the pandemic is sort of, it becomes very patient-centered, right? Makes us sort of question what are the hoops that we're making patients jump through that make us feel better, but aren't necessarily, needed for patient safety and that really end up being barriers.
I think it definitely speaks to the passion of like family planners in general. Like we were all just actively problem solving kind of on the back end, you know, outside of clinic, like how can we do this the easiest way possible? And sub-Q depot was something we could have always been doing.
Right.
We didn't realize, right, that this was something that we could have always been offering patients. We actually made like a little patient demo with me and one of my nurses, like her demonstrating giving it, so that we were then able to just quickly email them this quick video that said, you know, this is how you give it. It's not scary. And so I think it made a lot of patients, you know, much more comfortable with the idea of like giving themselves an injection or that they could have like a family member give it. But it was interesting to me that this is something we could have always been doing. And it took the pandemic to like make us take that extra step to kind of figure it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think sub-Q depot and self-administration is the perfect example. You know, it's so much easier. And, you know, we're all super busy and overwhelmed and all the time, let alone in a pandemic, but it's just easier to continue to do things in the model we've always done them. And so it's just, you know, we're comfortable with people coming into clinic and giving them a shot. And it doesn't seem like that big of a deal to us because it's a quick visit. But for a patient who has to get off work or get transportation or get childcare, it's a, you know, it can be a big deal.
Yeah, and I mostly see adolescent patients. And so I was pulling them out of school for it. You know, so like once I actually kind of sat down and thought about what we were doing, I was like, that, like you said, it might be a 15-minute visit, but lots of times they're missing at least a half day of school to come and get this injection that they could have been doing at home.
Yeah, one of the things to me that was so powerful was talking to a lot of the NPs and PAs at Planned Parenthood about their experience of doing birth control pills, like all these other birth, you know, the short acting birth control methods that don't require a visit by telehealth. And sort of, again, realizing that same, having that same realization that they had patients who were at work and literally going out behind, you know, by the dumpster in the back where people go to smoke to do their 5-minute visit, or running out to their car. There was one patient, I think, that was like in the freezer of like some, you know, fast food joint, like doing her 5-minute visit, and that they could, you know, they didn't even have to take off work, that this was something you could do, you know, when people picked up kids at school, you know, waiting to pick up your kid or on your 15-minute break at work. And that really, we're going to talk a little bit more about equity, but that really, I think, you know, to me, I love that patient-centered, that being forced to really be patient-centered, like truly patient. I mean, I think we think of things as being patient-centered within a clinical structure, but this idea of sort of getting outside of that.
I think it definitely pushed us, like you said, kind of outside of that box of the way that we'd been doing things for years and years. Yeah, I think one of the other really cool things about telehealth recently in birth control counseling was all of my kids who are in college. Because previously they would have to wait, right? If they didn't like their pill, they were just going to wait another 6 months until it was Christmas or until it was summer break, where they were able to come and kind of talk to me. And now they can kind of just make a telehealth visit and fit me in between classes. And we can quickly kind of talk about what are your options? What are the things, you know, can you switch to right now versus what do you actually have to wait for?
Right. Absolutely. I think, you know, that's a great point, because not even just for college students, but I think we know a lot, you know, almost 50% of patients aren't happy with whatever birth control method they start with when it comes to things like pills and the NuvaRing and the patch and even the shot. But they don't, you know, and that half are going to sort of stop it at a year because they're not happy, right? But they're not necessarily coming back to clinic while they're still on the method. And so they end up, you know, risking an unintended pregnancy or having an unintended pregnancy. And I think some of that is that hurdle and barrier of, you know, having to make an appointment and plan ahead and get off work and get childcare and get out of school and arrange transportation can make it seem like it's just not worth it, right? I'll just switch to condoms. Whereas if it's really a phone call away, and it's 5 minutes and it's, you know, it's super easy, it seems to me that when people are unhappy with their method, it can make it much more likely that they'll, you know, call and switch actively to another method as opposed to having these big gaps, which is what we know puts people at risk for unintended pregnancy. So do you think COVID, you know, how do you think COVID has affected patients' ability to get access to actual LARC methods that, if they want them, you know, need an in-person visit because the device has to be inserted?
I think at my institution, we were lucky, and that my patients were also really lucky, that within about 6 weeks, we were like up and running for contraception again. I think it was just having that conversation of like, what truly is essential healthcare? What are the things we can't push back? And so abortion right off the bat was always essential, which we were super proud of, but we fought a little bit harder for LARC devices. And then we had a clinic every Tuesday all day where it could even just be a walk-in where we just did LARC devices.
Right.
And so I think for us, you know, that one little place in Chicago, access was okay, but you definitely get worried about other places where there's already lots of barriers to birth control.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree. I think this gets back to what you were saying earlier about sort of the focus that family planning folks put on, you know, they know that all contraceptive methods are urgent, are necessary. These are not elective. These are not nice to haves. These are a matter of being pregnant when you don't want to be, or needing an abortion or not. And they are just as time sensitive and urgent as abortion care. But I think that, you know, for people who aren't so focused on preventing unintended pregnancy, like that's not necessarily how people see it. They can see birth control as sort of a, you know, more like getting a pap smear. And so obviously at Planned Parenthood, we had the same view, right? Like to us, birth control and abortion care were the two things that had to continue regardless, right? You know, pap smears could be put off, well woman checks could be put off. And I think, you know, it was interesting to me. And so we had the same thing. We continued to provide the services the whole time. But what was interesting to me is we were seeing, I was in New York, we were shut down. The whole state was shut down very early. We were seeing patients from all over the community who normally went to their, you know, to a private practice OBGYN, because the private practices had all shut down or were only doing really the most urgent, and so couldn't get their depo shots. And so we were getting tons of calls and patients coming in to get their depo shots with us because they couldn't get them from their regular doctor. And, you know, I even had a couple patients who ended up coming to me for abortion care because, you know, right at the beginning of the pandemic, they decided they wanted an IUD or an implant, but then, you know, the appointments got canceled and then it was basically put off indefinitely. And so I think that, you know, to me, it really is, you know, this care is so critical because people certainly don't stop having sex during a pandemic. And
yeah. Well, Well, and I think it's also if they were deferring like some of their other needed care, like for their diabetes or their lupus, and now they're getting pregnant potentially or not having contraception access and have uncontrolled disease. So it's just putting women at risk in general.
Absolutely.
At our institution, it was like an easy win. It didn't take very long, but I definitely know colleagues where it took longer, you know, so they had no abortion services for a certain period of time, or they weren't able to get LARC devices in. So they were really focusing on the short, short acting methods for, you know, for a few months.
Right. Well, I think your point about people's other, you know, comorbidities being more poorly controlled is absolutely right. And then I think you layer on top of this, we're in a pandemic, like the absolute worst time to have an unintended pregnancy or to be pregnant and giving birth when you don't want to be is during a pandemic when we don't know what the risk is to the pregnancy. We don't know what the risk is for that, you know, child. And when people are really facing a lot of unknowns and risks around, you know, jobs, healthcare, and everything that goes into that decision of whether, you know, they feel ready to bring a child into the world or not.
Yeah. And we definitely did see that. I think we saw more like couples or people who even, might have even been trying to get pregnant. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hit and they were like, oh no, you know, like, I don't want to do this right now. This isn't a good time. We don't know the research. We don't know what's going to happen in this pregnancy. And so they were reaching out for birth control where like 3 months ago, they were talking to me about, you know, prenatal vitamins and planning pregnancies.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you believe that COVID-19 may be affecting health equity? I feel like this is sort of like, I mean, it's not, I mean, obviously it's affecting health equity in all kinds of ways.
I think the fear is that it's just making a gap even wider, right? So the gap has always been there.
Correct.
And now when you just add one more hurdle, one more thing, that gap is just getting wider and wider.
Yeah.
And we know that, you know, there's certain racial and minority groups that are being more affected by COVID. They're more likely to be the essential workers that are, you know, having to be out there and working. And so I think, like you said, I think obviously it's affecting it, but I think it's just kind of widening that gap.
Well, yeah. And I mean, your point about the essential workers, I mean, I think, you know, pre-pandemic, when we look at the disparities in unintended pregnancy and access to contraception, we already had these huge disparities based on race and socioeconomic status. So, you know, the folks that are the most likely to be the CNAs working in the nursing home or, you know, working at Target or Walmart or having these more low paying jobs, who, you know, at the grocery store that are these essential workers, were already more likely to face an unintended pregnancy because they were less likely to get access to contraception before the pandemic. And then you put the pandemic on, right? And you now have even bigger gaps, both in those people's sort of economic support and their risk of COVID and their ability to get access to contraception.
And I think a lot of women just too, like schools closed. I mean, at least here in Chicago, all of a sudden there was no childcare. You had no transportation. You know, like there was just like all the things we already know that are issues for that patient population that already have access problems. You just kind of just like piled it on.
Right, right. I mean, I think, you know, sort of like when I think of my typical patient, you know, has three kids, is usually working two jobs because they're not even, the minimum wage isn't enough to support, you know, yourself. And they're often going to school on top of it, right? And so you think like, and you're already doing all of those things, how do you continue that when now your kids are home, they're not in school, you have to work to survive, you want to try to keep going to school because you're trying to like, you know, move to a job that maybe you can have one job instead of two. It felt like it was, you know, not a double whammy, I guess, quintuple whammy.
Well, and then I was just worried, like, how do you expect women in those situations to also like remember to take a pill every day? Right. Like,
right, no structure now.
Like, I know. I mean, I had two kids and I had no structure. I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have taken anything at the same time and every day.
I don't even know what day it is half the time. I mean, like, you know, you're like, is it? I mean, the other day I was like, oh, St. Patrick's Day. Is that today? And they're like, it's February. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just. You know, it's true. And like, I mean, the chaos of people's lives and just, and I think particularly for women, as often is the case, the disproportionate, you know, those responsibilities of childcare and then now being a teacher for your kids and working and cleaning and like, you know, and, you know, finding food at the grocery store, which may or may not be there, like all of those things become really overwhelming. I mean, I think they're overwhelming to folks that have the most resources.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you know, if I'm struggling and I have like a partner that helps me and I have, you know, all the extra resources to call upon and I'm struggling, I can only imagine what, you know, our patients are going through. So I definitely see why a lot of those women were like starting to think about LARC methods, right? Because they're like, I can't do this. Like, I already know I can't handle another baby. I'm not taking my pill or using my patch correctly because of all this stuff in life. And how do I even go to a pharmacy? In Chicago, there had recently been a bunch of like riots. So we also baseline didn't have pharmacies open.
Right.
So we had like no pharmacies. So that was already a problem here. And then you just kind of like keep adding more stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things I thought about, and I'm curious what you think, is what do you think is going to happen? Well, if we ever get post-pandemic, but you know, a girl can dream. So say we're post-pandemic, like, what do you think is going to happen to things like telehealth? What do you think is going to happen to these ways in which we stripped away the unnecessary parts of our care with the intention of protecting people from COVID, but with the effect of removing a lot of unnecessary barriers and really increasing access in a way that I think levels the playing field when we talk about things like socioeconomic disparities? Like, what do you think, you know, what do you hope is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think my hope is that there's no way we can go back, right? Like, I think it's one of those things that has now changed for long enough that people almost expect it. And so my hope is that people are advocating, especially at the state level and talking to the representatives. And in the city of Chicago, I think the whole state of Illinois, they recently said that they're covering it for the rest of the entire year. I don't know if that's a nationwide change, but telehealth is now going to be covered by insurances for the rest of this year of 2021. And so I just think that, or hope, I guess, that we can't go back. Yeah. So much has changed. I think in some ways that's much better. And so I think this is kind of here to stay and hopefully it just improves.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think it's going to be interesting to see, but you completely hit the nail on the head, right? Like, this is ultimately, it's going to depend on whether people can be reimbursed or not, because the minute, you know, especially private practices where you don't have other sources of funding, you know, the minute it's not reimbursed, it's not going to happen. And as much as patients may want it and expect it, you know, I think that role, particularly for physicians and patients, to advocate that this is good care and this is in fact better care, and so it should continue to be reimbursed, not just you know, during the pandemic and the sort of, you know, emergent situation, but really like long term. Because I think, you know, I do think it would be really, really hard after you've been providing care this way, when, you know, when you're providing it wanting to do what's best for patients, to suddenly make patients do things that you know are unnecessary, are burdensome, and are going to stand in the way of them getting access to contraception, right? Like, it'd be really hard to be like, oh, you have to come in person to get your birth control refill, right? When you know that they don't, right? That the only way to do that is so you can get paid, right?
Well, so, and I think a lot of other interests, like, you know, like the whole online birth control access thing. So I think if we don't do it, if medicine doesn't change and keep telehealth, women are just going to find another way. So they're going to turn to those kind of online services where you can do something like a checklist and then get those short acting methods. Which means then that potentially that population is not going to get all of the LARC information because that's not what's being offered to them. So I think we just also have to stay competitive.
Right. Well, and then it also means that now that patient is paying money out of pocket, they don't have to pay, right? Because birth control is available as a no-cost birth, as a no-cost benefit through all insurances, but only if you do it through a clinic, right? So, and those, I mean, most of those online websites don't deal with insurance, which is how they can do it so effectively and efficiently. I mean, people, and it's worth it to people to pay $30 or $40 to not have to, you know, take off work and get childcare and do all those things, right? And so I think that, but again, that's also not fair to then put that financial burden back on patients, because we can't move. I mean, we've shown that we can turn the system on a dime, right? Like, we've shown that we can make these changes in a very short time frame. Whereas I think without the pressure of the pandemic, people don't like change. And so it takes a long time to start doing things differently. And to me, I think that's what was really impressive to me, is how quickly we could really like just be really honest with ourselves about like, what are we doing that is necessary and what are we doing that is not? And how do we like strip away everything that's really not necessary and really just do what the patient needs to be safe and healthy? And then think like, oh my God, like, we've been making patients jump through all these hoops that they didn't really need to jump through.
And it's so interesting because, right, we've been talking about telehealth as like a medical community for 10 years. Like, I remember even when I was in training, it was starting like something that was coming up in conversation. But like you said, because it wasn't reimbursed by insurance, it wasn't something that got kind of steadily moved forward. So it's interesting, like you said, like bam, all of a sudden COVID hits, and within like I said, 4 to 6 weeks, everybody is using telehealth. It's just interesting. So I think that's like our, I think whenever I do these interviews or podcasts, I always have like a call for action kind of statement. And I think advocating as doctors and making sure that our patients are advocating that these things continue to be covered is going to be super important.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So as some states recognize prescriber status of more pharmacists during the pandemic, again, sort of trying to find outside of the box ways to increase access, what role do you feel they have to play going forward in stepping up access to short-acting birth control and LARC during these times, and I think post-pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's with Nexplanon, I feel like my daughter could put it in. You know, I'm always telling people, oh, and I think my kid could put that in, you know? And so
It's true.
I think like pharmacists obviously could. And I think in some ways, OB-GYNs act as like the gatekeepers to LARC. And I think the more that we can break that down, the, you know, more access we're offering to our patients, the, you know, more better experiences we are for our learners. I know our pediatric residents a couple of years ago learned how to do Nexplanons, and I think that was very empowering for lots of them because previously they had no long-acting methods that they were able to offer. So I just think like taking away that like gatekeeper to the LARC methods and trying to, you know, increase that to as many providers as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly, I think with Nexplanon, because it's such a low hanging fruit, right? Like it's, you know, pants stay on, so you don't have to deal with people who don't want to, you know, have to take their pants off. And it's like, it's a, you know, it's a 2 minute procedure. I mean, the procedure itself is 30 seconds. It's 2 minutes to numb them, you know, numb somebody up. But, you know, it's incredibly simple. Anybody can do it. And we know particularly for the very young teens, when we talk about pediatrics, who are least likely to be able to get to an OBGYN or go someplace else, who are likely to choose a LARC method are more likely to choose a Nexplanon or the implant as opposed to an IUD. We also actually here in Rochester, many years ago, as one of the resident projects was to institute standardized Nexplanon training into the residency, into the pediatric residency. And so now it's part of the peds residency, the med peds residency. The biggest barrier for them was actually getting the attendings in the continuity clinics to get trained, right? Because, you know, the new residents all want to do something new. People have been around the block are like, I don't really want to deal with this, right? But they did. They got all of the attendings trained in the regular pediatric continuity clinics. And now they get, you know, the standardized Nexplanon training as part of their intern orientation. So every peds resident, the meds peds resident leaves trained. And having done many in their own clinics, like not even an adolescent medicine clinic, which to me is phenomenal.
It's amazing. And I think as far as like low-hanging fruit, like the LARC methods, because they're progestin only, they are the ones that, you know, there's very few people who can't have them for any reason. You're not increasing the risk to pregnancies as far as like figuring out whether or not you think someone is pregnant. Nexplanons, it doesn't matter, right? If you put it in, it's not going to hurt a pregnancy. We could always just remove it. I just think it's just like, why not? Like, why are we
Right.
doing
You don't need to know anything. I mean, literally, you don't need to
that?
know anything, right? Like, because right, the only medical condition that would make it that would make it not be recommended is current breast cancer, right? I mean, like, literally, that's it. There's one, right? It's, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that I also think that there are ripple effects too, because I think when one, when people see is like, oh, that's only OBGYNs that can do these methods, then it allows people to sort of abdicate dealing with contraception and sexual health, which a lot of people who aren't OBGYNs don't want to deal with, right? But then once, and I think there's also this phenomenon of like, if you're not offering implants, like say you don't do implants or IUDs, you're not going to spend a lot of time talking to your patients about how great these methods are or offering them in the menu of options you offer them. If when they're like, oh, I'd love that, you're like, yeah, you can't have it because they don't do it, right? Like, I mean, you know, there's, you know, with the best of intentions, there's always going to be a bias there. And so I think, you know, there can be this perception of like, oh, my patients don't want these methods. But if you're not offering them, you don't really know because you're probably not talking to them about it. So what we found actually is sort of the farther ripple because the training in the pediatrics residency has been going on long enough that, you know, a lot of people stay in town and go and join practices. And so then they're like, oh, I want to provide, you know, the implant to my patients and like a general peds practice. And they sort of bring it in. And then the other providers are like, oh, our patients don't want that. And then suddenly like, oh, yes, they do. And then of course, nobody wants to be left out. And then they start getting trained. So we sort of seen as a follow-up to the residents sort of going out to the community that the practicing pediatricians in town out in the general peds practices are now wanting training, right?
Yeah, Rochester is like the place to get Nexplanon.
It is. It's the place. You know, I think it's that thing too. Of like, you don't realize that there's this unmet need. I mean, I think even as like family planning providers, you know, obviously I knew there was a huge unmet need for IUDs and implants for people in general, but I had no idea it was as big as what we saw in the Contraceptive Choice Project. Like, I mean, you know, I would have guessed in the Contraceptive Choice Project when cost barriers and, you know, information, like having the whole menu of options in your counseling and provider barriers were removed, I would have guessed, you know, of people who don't want to get pregnant the next year, 50% would have chosen IUD. Yeah. Like I never would have guessed, you know, 75. And so I think that those, you know, our perceptions of what people want and need that we sort of use to justify not changing our practice become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Well, and when you were talking about like maybe a provider talking about all the methods, but they don't do it, I think that also biases the patient a little bit, right? Like if you thought this was something that was important or you really liked it, then you would learn how to do it. And so since you don't do it, and now I would have to like leave my provider, my pediatrician, you know, because like I said, I take care of adolescents. They don't want to leave their pediatrician. This is the person that's been taking care of them for years and years. I'm like a big scary person that might do a pelvic exam and they want whatever their pediatrician offers. And so lots of times I think they do try the short acting methods for longer than they normally would because that's what their pediatrician has to offer. And so then, you know, down the road, they potentially will come to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, I think, you know, the theme that keeps coming up through this whole conversation is about, you know, removing these unnecessary barriers, whether those barriers are, you know, clinic barriers, in-person barriers, provider barriers, cost barriers. Like it's, you know, everybody, you know, almost everybody has sex at some point in their life, you know, right? I mean, not everybody, nuns. I mean, but like almost everybody has sex at some point in their life, right? You know, 95% of people have sex before marriage and, you know, need and use contraception. And if you want two kids, you've got to prevent pregnancy for like 30 years, right? First of all, that's a really long time to never have anything go wrong. It's a really long time to never mess up, but it's also a really long time to never forget a pill, to take a pill every day for 30 years without forgetting it, right? And so I think that this idea that contraception is just this like, you know, icing, nice to have kind of like, you know, like maybe you get a haircut, you don't get a haircut during the pandemic. It's like it's not true. I mean, it is, you know, this is about whether people have the number of children they want or not, or have to bring a child into, you know, a life where they're struggling to provide for the kids they already have. Like they're really truly life and death, you know, care, healthcare. I mean, this is like, this matters for people's lives, for that woman's life, for her children's lives. And I think that, you know, the idea that contraception is so often seen as like not that important, as being, you know, it's just sort of marginalized. It's seen as something that like, you know, that it's okay to send the person away to someplace else. It's okay to make the person come back for their method. It's okay to say, well, you can't get your birth control during a pandemic, just stop having sex or use condoms, right? Like that I think, you know, until we see contraception as being as important and critical to women's health, to women's health, to children's health, to health of all people. And the fact that it's something that everybody needs and everybody uses for a large portion of their lives, you know, we're not gonna make the changes that we need to make these things available to people. Those are very preachy. Okay, so next question, what lessons in your opinion does the current COVID-19 pandemic hold for increasing access to medications through multiple channels?
I think we kind of, it's like almost like a summary of lots of the things we just said, right? I think that maybe your preaching can go in there.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, I think we also just showed as a healthcare system how flexible we are able to be, which I think, especially for big institutions, I think we all doubted it. I don't think we thought it would happen as quickly, that it would work as well. I mean, I jokingly say all the time that the best thing that came out of COVID was telehealth.
Absolutely.
I think I'm not joking, right? I mean, I think it's like changed my ability to connect with my patients. And like you said, I can connect for 5 minutes sometimes. And that means so much to them that they're actually able to like see and have a conversation with me about something that's a big decision in their life. Like, do they continue pills? Do they need to switch to something? So I think, I don't remember the question.
Do we think that the COVID pandemic will increase access to medications through multiple channels? And I mean, I think the answer is yes. I think one, it's making it more available through standard clinics with telehealth. But I think it's, you know, these online things that are completely, you know, disconnected from a physical clinic that are providing contraceptive care online. I think the pharmacy thing makes a lot of sense. I love your idea of pharmacists putting in Nexplanon. That's awesome. I mean, they're already giving the flu shot. Again, pop your arm out, pop it in. Yeah. You know, the other thing that has been really incredible sort of in this realm of reproductive health is access to abortion. And obviously that was a huge issue with the pandemic, right? Because obviously people, you know, it's a very timely, you know, it's timely care, it's urgent care, it's life-changing care. And to me, that was also what was sort of impressive, was our ability to sort of like pivot to medication abortion, you know, through telehealth. And in that same way that we sort of stripped away the unnecessary barriers for contraception, we did the same thing with medication abortion, right? Like, you know, I saw things where we knew there was evidence to extend gestational age or to maybe not check, you know, RH status or use Rogam at earlier gestational ages that we've been talking about for a couple of years. Everybody felt pretty comfortable with. We're like, oh yeah, we're going to change that, right? And then like on a dime, again, it forced us to sort of say like, what are we doing with adding unnecessary expense and barriers that isn't benefiting anybody, right? Or it's just making us feel more nervous.
I'm so glad you say that though, because I think we also all thought it was just us, right? Like in our clinic, we thought we were doing a great job, and especially with abortion and getting patients to come back so we can talk about birth control again. But then as COVID hit, the same thing. Like we just tried to say like, oh, there's actually home follow-up and there's a whole different way that we can do this. Yes. And you don't have to come back. And the same thing, we knew the evidence was there. I mean, we're all very smart people, but we just hadn't made that switch yet because of like these certain like either barriers or biased thoughts that we all kind of had.
I think some of it honestly is nervousness, right? Like I think as physicians, like we're, you know, we self-select as physicians, we are not risk-taking people, right? Like you don't want a risk-taking doctor, right? Like we are very like risk-averse, follow the rules, be really careful, be really safe. And like really, like we, and sometimes go too far in being really, really careful to sort of protect against anything bad happening, that sometimes we're actually causing, you know, inadvertent harm through these unnecessary barriers and limiting access. And I think that, I think there's some of that with contraception. I think there's more of that obviously with abortion, and particularly, you know, and with the medication abortion because of the politics around it and the concerns of all of that. But like, you know, I mean, I have to say even for me, like the idea of doing phone follow-up with a pregnancy test in 4 weeks prior to the pandemic felt uncomfortable. And I'm like pretty good at wanting to like push those barriers and decrease, you know, decrease unnecessary barriers, increase access. And even I was like, I'd feel much better if you came in, I could do it. But again, it was about me. I would feel much better if you came in, I did an ultrasound and I could see with my eyes that everything was okay, right? And so, you know, to me, but again, I got comfortable real quick. Like the minute it was about patients getting access to care or not, right? Like then it was very easy to get comfortable very quickly with these changes that I think would have taken, and again, you can't go back. Like once everybody's been doing, and I think, you know, in a place like Planned Parenthood where, you know, the care is almost all delivered by NPs and PAs, you know, if I think sort of pre-pandemic to trying to get NPs and PAs to move from ultrasound to like phone follow-up and a urine pregnancy test, they would have been really nervous, right? Like I feel like in some ways they're even less risk averse than physicians. And it would have been really hard to get people to feel comfortable to start doing that, to make that change. And then with COVID, because of that pressure and that immediacy, it happened overnight. And of course, there's no going back because now that everyone's done it and the sky hasn't fallen in, whatever. The sky's still up in the sky, you know, and everyone's realized, oh, people can tell when it hasn't worked and they will call us and they do come back and that this stuff does work and is safe. I mean, to me, I feel like that's the little bit of silver lining that's come out of that is it's, you know, it's forced us to make these changes very quickly that really, really benefit our patients. And I hope that experience for all of us, because I do think it was a dramatic experience, will help us to continue to look at things that way, even when we're not in a pandemic, that it will help us to continue to, you know, really actively question like what we're doing and the way we're doing things. And does this person really need to come into clinic for this care? Do I really need to be running this test or doing this extra thing? Am I doing this because it makes me feel better? Or am I doing this because it is really what we need for the patient to be safe?
I think it was just like the push we needed, right? Like it was the thing that we haven't had anything like this in years and years and years. And so it was like the thing that just kind of pushed all of us to, you know, start thinking about things a little bit differently. And I think it has, because I think now like our hospital is back to kind of allowing visitors again. And we're like in a much like safer feeling kind of place as far as COVID. But I think we are all actively still thinking about those things as far as like, how can we make sure that those things stay plus keep moving forward and adding like things that make patient care a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So last question we have is, so do you feel that the current pandemic will lead to a more collaborative healthcare model across the spectrum of healthcare providers? Why or why not?
I think in general, we got really good at, so for myself, I think I work a lot with different pediatricians and especially like subspecialists. So they'll maybe be seeing a patient for, you know, rheumatoid arthritis or type 1 diabetes. And we got just much more, you know, contacting each other much more often and just saying, you know, them being more comfortable ever before saying, is there anything that I could just start today? Like, you know, is there something that I could just tell the patient and then we could start this today and then I could just follow up with you? And so even since then, like now I have a young women's bleeding disorder clinic because we worked so closely during the pandemic to try to make sure these kids weren't having to come in to the ER, the ones who have bleeding disorders and who have heavy periods, or they don't have to come back to the ER, that now we just decided to start a clinic where we see patients together. So I definitely think that, you know, all of the different teams just had to kind of, you know, meld together and try to figure out how can we best take care of our patients and limit the amount of times they have to come back to the hospital. And hopefully that will continue.
That's great. Anything else that you want to say? I think we've hit all of the highlights. This has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it.
I think the only other thing I was thinking about as far as the collaborative is that a bunch of the physicians that I work with, we've also become much more involved in education of physicians assistants and APNs. And I think that's something we didn't necessarily think about as much before. You probably do because you work with them at Planned Parenthood on a more regular basis. But lots of times they're like the front line, right? They're going to potentially see patients way before I do and probably on a more regular basis. And so we need to make sure that they have, you know, that toolkit of all the different contraceptive methods and that they're doing really good counseling that they feel comfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Trueheart. This was a wonderful conversation. It was so nice talking to you today. And thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.